Good afternoon and welcome to the EcoNews Report, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, EcoNews. You can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the archives page at khsu.org. I'm Ken Burton. My guest is Chris West, senior wildlife biologist for the Yurok Tribe, and we're going to talk about the tribe's condor reintroduction project. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Years ago, I interviewed you about condors on this show, and now as things have played out, I work for the tribe too. Lots has happened on the condor reintroduction front since then. Let's start with a brief recap of the tribe's reintroduction program, and then let's talk about some of the latest developments and what's on the horizon.
All right. Well, we've been working on condors for quite some time. The tribe initially started looking at the potential for reintroducing condors to the region in 2003 and kind of slowly worked towards trying to raise funds and whatnot to start some actual on-the-ground efforts. In 2008, they secured their first funding to actually engage in some condor restoration activities, most of which was just doing habitat assessments to try and look at the condition of the habitat. It's been over a century since condors flew the skies around here, so they wanted to make sure that everything looked good, the habitat was still capable of supporting a thriving population of condors. At that time, when they first secured those funds, is about when I got hired on to oversee the project and start running those assessments. Through that work, we've done a lot of habitat assessments, looked at what kind of habitat is out there. Things have changed a lot. There used to be a lot more prairie. It's been converted to forest at this point. Looking at food sources, potential flight corridors, things like that. We also looked quite a lot at contaminants issues. These are the primary things that probably initially caused condors to disappear from this region and are the main challenges facing the conservation program at this time. So we looked at lead levels in other avian scavengers out there because we know that condors succumb to lead toxicosis quite frequently.
And those other scavengers would be vultures and ravens.
Turkey vultures and ravens, yes. We also looked at marine mammals. It's turned out that contaminants in marine mammals have had effects on the reproduction of condors in other areas. Primarily that's DDT that is still out there in the marine food chain, not so much affecting seabirds anymore because levels have come down. You know, the low levels that still exist in fish tend to accumulate and biomagnify in marine mammals, which are large food sources that wash up on beaches and are available to condors to feed on.
Mm-hmm.
Those magnified levels are still impacting condors. It leads to eggshell thinning for the birds and failure of eggs in the nest, primarily due to water loss and resulting embryo death.
And my understanding from your findings is that those levels, while still perhaps significant, are lower here in general than in other parts of California.
Well, with respect to the marine mammals, the primary cause for the contamination was the kind of widely known Montrose chemical plant down in Southern California, who were actively dumping waste products into the waterways, led to very high levels in the Palos Verdes shelf area down there.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the primary source. What we found is that, you know, people have looked in Central California and Southern California, also in Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and we were kind of a large empty zone where there was not a lot of data collected. So we collected samples from marine mammals washed up on beaches around here. Really what you find is a nice tapering effect as you go from south to north, very high concentrations in the south still, relatively, and then as you go north, it just tapers right off. So the problems that have been encountered by condors are mostly in Central California, and we have somewhere around a factor of 10 times lower in this area. So we're hoping that's low enough that we wouldn't see effects in birds, but until we get birds breeding in this area, it's really hard to make a judgment call.
Yeah. You know, condors have been gone from this area for so long that it's easy to forget that they were ever here, but they are integral to the cultural tradition of the Yurok and other tribes in the area.
Yeah, condors have been viewed in a lot of different ways by a lot of the tribes ranging, you know, throughout essentially the species range. You get a bird that's that large and impressive, it's hard for it not to have some sort of an impact on your interaction with the environment that you're both sharing. So it was incorporated into a lot of the local traditions and beliefs and creation myths of a lot of the tribes up and down the West Coast. For the Yurok people, One of the primary things was that the feathers are used as regalia in a lot of the dances, and condors figure prominently into a lot of the high dances. Part of that is because it's believed that condor was one of the first peoples of the earth created, and therefore had a hand in the creation and preparation of the world for other species, including people. So that really puts condor in a very important place. Plus, you know, the inability for the tribe to get feathers from the environment the way that they did in the past, collect them from roost sites and whatnot, where they were considered to be gifts to the people that were imbued with the spirit of the condor and therefore participated in their ceremonies with them, as well as the fact that they were considered to be the messengers which helped carry prayers of the people. If your messenger that's carrying prayers is absent from the system, that's a pretty big deal. So That's why the Council of Elders back in 2003 decided that of all the terrestrial species, recovery of condor was probably the most important to the Yurok people. You know, I'm speaking from the perspective of the Yurok, but there are a lot of other tribes out there that hold very important beliefs for condors and place condors at a very high level within their systems of belief and creation myth. And so I think this is something that's important to a huge array of the native peoples along the West Coast.
And are any of the other tribes in the Pacific Northwest following the Yurok's lead in reintroducing condors to their ancestral territories?
Yes, they are. Actually, a grant was just secured this last year by the Nez Perce tribe. They're kind of on the border of Idaho and Oregon, and they secured a grant very similar to the grant that the Yurok tribe received in 2008, where we were just initiating our examination of the habitat and the potential for reintroduction. And that's kind of right where Nez Perce is just embarking on their journey right now. And it's really exciting to have them on board. We've had a lot of communication with them. They're really excited about the potential to bring condors back to the Hell's Canyon region that kind of straddles the border of those two states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really exciting. So you mentioned earlier that a lot of the prairie habitat has been lost from the Yurok Reservation and other Yurok tribal lands. And I think that's a nice segue into some of the new partnerships that have formed around the tribe's reintroduction efforts, particularly with Redwood National and State Parks. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, Redwood National and State Park has been a very strong proponent of our condor efforts from the very beginning, all the way back to when we first started up doing our avian scavenger work, which was, you know, we started in late 2008 when we finally got the ball rolling and got the grant money secured and started doing some field work. Right off the bat, our first round of trapping that happened within a few months of getting started happened on Redwood National Park land. They allowed us onto their lands. They were really supportive of us, you know, doing some of the contaminants work, really excited about the potential to have condors here. Since that time, there's been turnover in the leadership at Redwood National Park, and time and again, the leadership has been extremely supportive of what we're doing. The parks have been really behind what we're doing, and they've really been our strongest advocate here on the North Coast.
Which is really great, and these sorts of efforts don't come cheap. So
they don't. No. People often say it takes a village to do this or that, but it really does take a village to do condor work. It's a large, complex species. It covers massive amounts of territory.
Yeah, we can't expect or even want the birds to stay on tribal lands.
No. I mean, it'll be great to have them hanging around and be available for the tribe to see, but we're talking about, you know, doing something that's not just a recovery for the Yurok tribe. This is a species that can be roosting on the coast in the morning and foraging over Mount Lassen in the afternoon. So it's a really massive area, and it's something that the tribe is, it's part of their mission to bring balance back to the world as a whole. A species that's as far ranging as this is a great example of that.
Well, no one can say we're not ambitious. Another new partner is PG&E.
Yeah, that's something that actually came about through the relationship with the National Park Service and Redwood National and State Parks. 2016 was the centennial, the 100-year anniversary of the Park Service. Through that, we teamed up with the National Park Foundation and were looking for money to support the Condor Project as one of the centennial projects. So we put our feelers out and did some presentations to some large funding organizations through the National Parks Foundation and with the National Parks Foundation as a partner. And PG&E was very interested in what we were doing out here. I would have to add that PG&E is not new to the condor conservation world. They have been working for some time with Ventana Wildlife Society. Mm-hmm. Part of that was there was a power line that was pretty close to the Ventana release site, and a number of condors actually collided with that power line and were killed. There was a lot of talk about what should be done, and PG&E stepped up and said, you know, we're just going to bury that power line. And it was somewhere to the tune of $4 to $6 million, something like that. Very expensive project. PG&E stepped up and they buried the power line. They've been really kind of tight with the Condor conservation community ever since. So we're really happy to extend that relationship with PG&E to the North Coast.
Yeah, that's great. Are there a lot of transmission lines in this area that are of concern?
There's not really too many. When we started looking at the area and coming up with good potential areas for placing actual reintroduction sites, we sat down with PG&E and with Pacific Power, who kind of runs the power grid north from our region up into Oregon, kind of looked at where the different sites were, looked at their transmission line maps. Both of those companies, you know, put their own internal groups to work doing analyses of where these areas are, what the potential threats were to the birds. And so before we even really got too far off the ground, they had given us, you know, potential threat maps and full analyses of where they thought the sites we had been looking at fell out in a ranking kind of a system where they could say, these sites are a little bit too risky, it would probably be best not to use these, and these sites would be really good. It wasn't a one-time deal. Both of them have been on board and involved in this process for quite some time. So they continue to be involved examining every step of the project to make sure that there's not going to be a conflict of that sort.
Yeah. So let's come back to lead ingestion is perhaps the most significant threat to condor reestablishment. Part of laying the groundwork for this whole effort is documenting and reducing the threat of lead ingestion before the birds arrive. I know that some of the most exciting developments in the last couple of years are related to lead availability in the environment. Let's talk about that a little bit. Legislation and also the tribe's education and outreach efforts.
Well, I'll start with the scavenger work that I mentioned earlier. Basically, we found that there's lead out in the environment, which isn't a big surprise. People still hunt with lead ammunition. People use lead ammunition for taking wildlife and even domestic animals. Whenever you put a piece of lead into something that can be consumed by something, you're basically introducing lead into the food chain. The main problem with lead, of course, is that when you fire a bullet that is made of lead at a target, the bullet deforms when it hits the thing, especially when you've got a hunting round, which are basically designed to mushroom, deform, fragment. That's how those projectiles transmit their energy into your animal that you're trying to kill. That deformation and transfer of energy results in disruption of capillary beds and tissues and whatnot, resulting in the death of the animal. This is essential, especially when a hunter wants to take an animal quickly, cleanly, humanely. You want massive disruption like that so that the animal dies quickly. Really, these lead bullets are doing what they're designed to do. Mm-hmm. But the problem in that is that as they deform, they also fragment. So it's not just one projectile. A lot of times a hunter says, well, I pulled my bullet out and I've got the whole thing, or it went through and through and it's not there anymore. But what they don't realize is that most lead bullets only retain 60 to 70% of their lead material in the main mass of the bullet. That means that 30 to 40% is becoming small fragments that are scattered through the wound channel. You don't want to eat that if you're a hunter and you're harvesting game. Usually what people do is they cut it out. And since usually you're also in relatively remote locations while you're hunting, people tend to cut out as much as they can that they don't want to use and leave it there in the environment. Now, this is a great practice for scavengers, because you, just like any other predator out there on the landscape, are now leaving portions of your kill to be consumed by the scavenging community. You're part of the whole cycle of life out there in the woods at that point in time. But what you're leaving behind is full of toxic fragments. You're not doing a service to the community.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I've seen those fragments. They're, I mean, it's like dust. You can't.
Yeah, and it takes a very, very small piece of lead. People always refer to the fingernail clipping. I think we've actually decided it's less than that at this point in time. That it takes to kill a condor or an eagle. So that's a huge concern. And also, if you're shooting for the vitals like most hunters do, you're scattering that stuff through the gut pile, through the lungs, all these things that typically get left in the field. So again, great resources for scavengers, but not if they're full of a toxic material.
Yeah.
At that point in time, you can either get rid of that stuff, bury it, make it unavailable, which is very difficult to do, or you can make a transition to something that's non-lead. And that's the direction that we've been going, is reaching out to to the hunting community with the outreach that you mentioned, our Hunters as Stewards project, where we try and engage with the hunting community and explain to them that this is a problem, but we're not trying to point fingers at hunters. Finger pointing doesn't get you really anywhere, and hunters are not really part of the problem, but they're part of the solution. That's how we try and look at it and how we engage with the hunting community. Hunters are the answer. We can transition to non-toxic types of ammunition, and hunters can go out there, hunt, harvest their game, and bring clean, healthy food home to their families. Mm-hmm. At the same time, be part of a healthy ecosystem by leaving the materials that they're not going to consume out there, that are not filled with toxic materials, and provide a really good, healthy meal for the scavenging community at the same time.
Yeah. You're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm Ken Burton of the Yurok Tribe Wildlife Program, and I'm talking to my boss, Chris West, about the current state of condor reintroduction efforts on the North Coast. So there's some fairly new legislation on the books now that backs up the tribe's education and outreach efforts around non-lead ammunition.
Yeah, so back when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor, he put a law into effect banning lead within the range of the California condor, which at that time was Central and Southern California. That was followed up by the Ridley Tree Condor Preservation Act, which augmented that, just changed some of the verbiage. That was really all the protection that was there for quite some time. Then Assembly Bill 711 was put into place more recently. That started being phased in 2016. At this point in time, it's illegal to hunt most upland game with shotgun ammunition that is lead, and it's illegal to use lead for hunting bighorn sheep in California. There are still a few species of upland game that you can hunt with lead. I think dove, quail, and maybe snipe. I'm not sure on that. Don't quote me on that. And the final phase-in is going to be occurring in 2019, and at that point in time, it'll be illegal to hunt any upland game or any game at all with shotgun or large caliber ammunition that's lead. That will effectively remove lead from being able to be used in California. Now, there's a lot of different ways to approach this, and California decided to move forward with the legislative approach. The tribe was not part of that push. The tribe has maintained that it's a hunter's choice, and that empowering hunters with information about the effects of lead on the health of wildlife and human health is the best way to move forward and make a transition to a lead-free future for hunting. But California decided to go a different route. That's, you know, California's California. They're doing what they're doing, and the tribe's not going to tell them how to run their state.
Right. We should mention that the tribe as a sovereign nation is not subject to state laws.
It is not subject to state laws. And it, as I said, the position of council has been California runs California, and the tribe's not going to tell them how to do their business. So we did not take part in the legislative process at all there. And we've just maintained that we're going to continue to do our outreach work with the hunting community and go from that side of things. The tribe is largely subsistence. We have a lot of hunters in the tribe, and so our outreach campaign has been very heavy, leaning towards trying to get tribe members to make the transition, because we're trying to target having a healthy community here, especially for the children and women with developing babies and things like that. We know about the neurological impacts of lead, and they're a major concern to the tribe and to the tribal council. So, you know, we will be continuing that work moving forward. Mm-hmm. There's also legislation that just went forward recently, and that is Senate Bill 1235, I believe, is the bill. Mm-hmm. And that's nothing to do with lead. There was also a measure on the ballot, I believe it was 65. And both of those address the ability to purchase ammunition in the state of California and whether background checks are needed and face-to-face transfers. And that's definitely throwing a little bit of a wrench into the non-lead outreach work, because a lot of groups out there, including ourselves, were purchasing ammunition and then doing giveaways mm-hmm. and exchanges yeah. for lead ammunition and things like that, so we could try and get non-lead ammunition into the hands of hunters. Under these new laws, we can't do that anymore. There has to be background checks. There has to be face-to-face exchanges with verified retailers. So that's kind of taking some of the tools out of our toolboxes. The other issue is non-lead ammunition has not been widely available at all retailers, especially in more rural locations. locations. So when we talk to people, we've been primarily saying go to the internet if you can't find it at your local store, but that is not going to be an available method of getting ammunition into the future in California. So That's made things a little bit more challenging. We're really trying to ramp up our efforts to engage with the retailers out there to make sure that this ammunition is widely available to California hunters.
Right. So there's legislation working both for and against this effort.
To a certain extent. And we're working through that with partners. I mean, we have partners at the state level who are recognizing the challenges here and are working with us through some of these loopholes. There was going to be potentially a state voucher program to try and get some lead ammunition into hunters' hands, but this has made that a little bit more challenging. But the folks at the state that we have been working with have been really engaging with us on this and putting a lot of effort into it. So hopefully All these things will be resolved.
Yeah. Obviously, reintroducing condors is not as simple as just getting hold of some birds and throwing them out onto the landscape. There's a lot of paperwork involved, and we're dealing with federal laws such as the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act. And I know that's been taking up a lot of your time lately. What are some of the more interesting aspects of that component of this project?
Well, the most interesting thing to me, I guess, is the fact that I went into wildlife biology so that I could be out of doors. And
I don't see you out of doors very often.
I sit in an office at a computer. I guess that's maybe not interesting. Maybe it's something that
you and I both, Chris.
But I guess, you know, a lot of people don't really understand what's involved in the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. But essentially, it's difficult to do something that is going to impact others that are out in public. If you're going to do something and it's going to impact your neighbor, then it's really best to engage with your neighbor and talk to them about it first so that you have an understanding of what's going to occur. And it's very similar to that. If you're going to put an endangered species on the landscape in a place where they haven't been before, then you have to consider the fact that there are people out there that are managing the land. There are timber companies that are needing to extract wood from the forests so that we can build houses and people can have places to live and do all the things that we do with those natural resources. But when you've got an endangered species there and they're protected by the Endangered Species Act, then that can somewhat curtail what those resource managers are allowed to do in those areas. So when you're considering doing an action such as this, you have to make sure that you bring everyone to the table and really sit down and discuss these things and find out how everyone feels about them and come to a conclusion. So when you go through the NEPA process, normally what you do is you end up coming up with a bunch of alternatives. So you think, okay, what if we don't do anything? What if we don't reintroduce condors?
The no action alternative.
What does that do to condors? How does that affect condors and their ability to survive and recover? Okay, well, if we do want to bring condors back, how could we do it? We could put them in multiple places. We could put specific rules down such that the birds are protected, or maybe there's a relaxation of protections under the Endangered Species Act to make things more palatable to those that are trying to use the resources. And so you end up with a bunch of these alternatives, and then you end up going and having some public meetings where you invite the public to come, you invite industry to come, you invite tribes to come. Everyone comes and can sit down, talk about things, and kind of give their input on how they feel about the different alternatives, what's the best way to move forward, so that kind of you can reach, hopefully, a consensus and decide what the best approach forward is.
Mm-hmm. We should probably mention that there are about half a dozen of those meetings coming up in the very near future, including two locally.
Mm-hmm. There's going to be one coming up
January 24th in Eureka.
January 24th at the Warfinger Building.
Yep, 6 o'clock.
At 6 o'clock till 8 o'clock in the evening. And then one on the 25th in Klamath at the Yurok Tribal Offices. And that's going to be from 10 in the morning until noon. And then there's also going to be meetings in Sacramento, Medford, Oregon, and Portland, Oregon. You can actually go to the park's webpage. Redwood National Park has set up a page to kind of examine the Condor project and give information. You can go
nps.gov/REDW.
Yeah, that's the main Redwood National Park webpage. And if you just scroll down to the bottom of the page, you'll see a big picture of a soaring condor, and you can click on that and look at a kind of a full description of what we're intending to do. And there's all the dates for the meetings and all the addresses of the meeting locations.
Mm-hmm. And we have the information on the local ones posted on the Yurok Tribe Wildlife Program's Facebook page as well.
Excellent.
So, yeah, what are these meetings going to be like? What's the format? What kind of topics are going to be covered?
Well, I think we're going to have kind of a basic introduction where people that attend get welcome to the meeting, and then there will be a description of how things are going to be laid out at the meeting, which is going to be what we're calling an open house format. So there's going to be a number of different stations where we have information on different topics. There will be information on environmental issues, on condor biology, on cultural concerns. So a lot of those sorts of aspects, we're going to have a lead outreach table. One of the big things I think that's going to have information presented is going to be on the potential for a 10J population. And that's a specific exception under the Endangered Species Act, where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service can designate a population as experimental and non-essential.
There. Nothing like putting half of your professional life into a non-essential project.
Well, I still consider it essential. I think there's a misunderstanding when it comes to that. A lot of people say, gee, you're going to put an endangered species out on the landscape, and then you're essentially going to say that they're not protected by the Endangered Species Act, which is what the 10J ruling would do. But what that does is you still can retain protections, and we would be retaining protections, and there's a bunch of different alternatives, again, through this NEPA process, that what do we want to retain as protections, but you can relax certain things. So if you can say, for instance, oh gee, someone wants to go out and shoot a condor, they're still going to be in violation of the Endangered Species Act. But if a condor accidentally gets disturbed or killed in the process of, say, a timber harvest operation where they didn't intend to harm the bird, they just didn't know it was there, then they won't be necessarily found guilty of an infraction against the Endangered Species Act. So you can kind of set up your regulations so that the large scale land managers aren't going to necessarily be as impacted as they could be, so that you can essentially work with your partners and say, hey, you know, we want support from the timber industry to bring this species back and protect this species. And, you know, it goes a long way to extend your hand and say, look, we'll you know, make sure that you're not going to be impacted, but we want your support. And then, you know, and we've already, you know, had conversations with some of the local timber companies, and they've been very supportive of what we're doing. It goes a long way to that sort of a thing.
So what opportunity is there for public input that might affect the outcome of these decisions?
Well, really the purpose of these public scoping sessions is to allow the public to come, get the information that they need about the project so that they can make an informed decision, and then hopefully provide us comments. All of the people that are going to be working at these meetings are going to be able to take comments from people that are attending them. There's also going to be the possibility for the public to log into online resources to put comments into the system. And every one of the stations at the open house format where people engage with people will have comment cards available. And we're urging people to come out, as many people as possible. We want everyone to weigh in on this. This really needs to be a big public effort.
Yeah, and I think they're going to be very interesting meetings and exciting, and I wish I could go, but I'm going to be out of the country. But I know that, you know, you guys will do a great job, and I'm very interested to hear how they go.
We've been working up to this for a long time, and we're really excited about this.
Yeah, it all is really exciting. And so just ballpark, how much time do you think we might be looking at before we actually can look up and see a condor?
Well, when I started on the project, I put the timeline at 2013, and clearly that didn't happen. So I try and avoid hard and fast dates. I'd still like to see 2019 at this point, but all this comes down to this meeting process, coming up with the alternatives and coming to consensus with the public and our partners. That's really going to be the deciding factor. So getting everyone out there to provide input, good or bad, is the most important thing we can do at this point.
Yeah, and of course, we are entering some very uncertain waters right now with regard to the federal administration. So who knows what's coming?
Most of the funding for this project has come from federal sources, and so we expect to see some changes in the future. We can't predict what those are at this point, but we will push forward and maybe diversify our funding base if we can, but we still remain optimistic.
Great. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you very much, Chris, for taking the time to do this.
Thank you for having me.
This has been the EcoNews Report. My name is Ken Burton, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today has been Chris West, senior wildlife biologist for the Yurok tribe, and we've been talking about California condor reintroduction on the North Coast. For more information, check out the October-November 2016 issue of EcoNews and the Yurok Tribe Wildlife Program Facebook page, as well as the Redwood National Park website. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 707-826-6089. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again for the EcoNews Report.